upon their arrival was almost unspeakable.
We are all evil in some form or another.
I'm not guilty.
The dead won't bother you. It's the living you gotta worry about.
If I couldn't keep them there with me whole, at least I felt that I could keep their skeletons.
Happy anniversary. Welcome to the Bad Days Crime Podcast. I'm Janelle.
I'm Vicky.
We have a special guest in the room.
Hey, me.
Tiff. It's Tiff.
So, as you might have noticed, it's our anniversary. Janelle's the only one that remembered. I didn't remember, that's for sure.
It's fine. Fine. It's not in my calendar or anything.
So this is how many years? 5 years?
6 years.
Six years? Oh, my God. Oh, my God. This has been going on too long.
We need to get out of this relationship now. Blink twice if you need help out of this relationship.
Yeah. So we decided to start this week's episode with opening these lovely gifts that Tiff or Janelle brought to us. I'm sorry, Tiff's actually in the room, which is not doesn't happen.
This never happens.
So we're gonna open them. What is you said this was the
So it's the iron anniversary.
Okay. And I love these bags.
I got an iron gift for both of you, but Vicky's got lost in the mail, so I had to do a plan B, and yours might need some explanation.
Okay.
Because it is mortifying.
Okay, so what did you get, Tiff?
It's an cast iron pan.
Star Wars.
Pancake
what
pan.
Is it Baby Yoda?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cute.
Oh, that's cute.
Okay. Now I'm wondering.
So, you need stuff for your house. So I got you something for your house, Vicky.
Okay, so. This
pull
is...
it out. It's for your keys.
No.
It goes on the wall.
Yeah. Okay,
and
so.
And you can put stuff on the top of the hand as well.
This is a it's basically a giant.
It's called a witch hand.
Metal. Yeah, witch hand is good. With like claws, and there's an eyeball in the palm. This is very cool.
I unpacked
this
it and
is
I was
very
like,
cool.
This is so huge. I thought it was smaller.
Yeah, no, this is straight up. This is bigger than my hand.
Mm-hmm.
This is so cool.
The wait, pictures were like, hang jewelry and keys. And I'm like, jewelry off of that thing would be mortifying.
Oh my
keys
gosh.
Is cute. Keys
I
is fun.
I love this because, so I recently moved into a new apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the stuff that I have in my house is skull or skeleton related mm-hmm. or horror related or yep. kind of weird. I've got a giant like UFO War of the Worlds picture in my dining room, and like I mean this is my house. I've never met my landlord. He has been over to the apartment multiple times uh-huh. to fix various things, and every time it's like a Wednesday when I'm in the office. So I've never met him. Mm-hmm. He has never met me. He has only seen the inside of my apartment. So I cannot wait to hang something like this on the wall for the next time he has to come in and do something in my apartment and be like, who is this woman?
The original thing I was going to get you, they were cast iron bats that were for keys.
Oh,
yeah,
that's
it was like
cute
a pair
too.
Of bats crawling up the wall. They're very cute, but they got
oh
lost
my God.
In the mail.
I love this, though. Thank you so much.
I was like, Plan B is a giant witch hand.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
All the screws are in the bottom, so.
I saw.
You have fun hanging that.
We'll see. It might sit on my counter until I buy a house. We will see about that. Oh, that's lovely. What a great way to start the show.
Happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary.
Y'all?
Thank you,
Janelle. Anniversary. I'm gonna go make
no fancy cookies or cupcakes this time. No bottles of wine.
Just witch hands. And pancakes.
And pancakes.
Thanks, Tiff. Bye. Okay, right. Now that it's just the two of us. No.
Just the two of us. Mm. We can make a podcast if we try.
I don't even know about that anymore.
You're welcome.
So, if this is your first time listening, a special hello to you.
God help you.
We've got a very interesting show for you today. But first, let's head over to the newsroom.
Fit to breathe, our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us it's a today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes, as if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad.
Okay, so our news today comes from Insider, where I probably should have saved this one for the next episode, actually.
It's fine.
But that's okay. Okay, so a woman named Patricia Kopta went missing in Pittsburgh in 1992.
Okay.
Okay, they assumed she had died. She was declared legally dead by authorities, but she was recently found living in Puerto Rico.
Well, that's a happy ending.
Yeah, kind of.
Uh-oh.
Confirmed by DNA. Uh-huh. She had actually been like a street preacher in Pittsburgh known as the Sparrow.
Okay.
But
that sounds like a comic book character.
There are reports that she had maybe some schizophrenia, maybe some mental illness. And so she became worried and like didn't want to get committed by her family. And so she fled the country. So she was actually found wandering the streets of Puerto Rico in like 1999. But when they found her now she is in her, she's 86. Or no, I'm sorry. Her husband is 86. She is, I think, also in, 83. She's since been diagnosed with dementia. She's living in a nursing home in Puerto Rico, which is kind of the unfortunate thing because like you almost wonder, like, especially with dementia, like she's not gonna be able to tell anybody like what happened during all those years necessarily. Yeah. Or if she does, like how accurate is it? Cause
yeah.
So, but it's interesting that they, you know, she was married, she had a husband, her parents, her sister, like all of these people for like 20 years thinking she's dead. She's just living in Puerto Rico.
Hey, what you got to do if you don't want to get committed?
I mean, I you guess. You got
to flee the country, kind of.
I'm glad that they were able to find her, like, before she passed on. Because, like, she's, I mean, 83 is, like, not young.
No.
You know what I mean? although I think, honestly, I think in Puerto Rico, the life expectancy is a little higher. They're, like, one of those, like, happier nation type people that generally just live a lot longer.
Maybe not in recent years, because you know all the
what do they call
natural they call them? Disasters and whatnot.
Yeah, I think they're called blue nations or something, where it's like they tend to. Anyway, maybe Puerto Rico. Maybe I'm thinking Costa Rica. Could be. Anyway,
it's an island, so you would think they're on island time.
Yeah. Moving right along to our Netflix and Kill this week, we are talking about the Pez Outlaw.
I watched this.
So good.
I just like the whole time I'm like, really?
Yeah. So
really?
The Pez Outlaw, it has a documentary on Netflix that follows Steve Glue, who was a Michigan machinist in like the 80s, who kind of one day decided to go to Europe and buy.
This is the confusing part.
Yeah. Basically, he went to Europe to buy Pez dispensers. So the way the market worked with Pez at the time was there was like the North American market and the international market, and the North American market was strictly controlled
down, solid.
By like what designs and colors and everything was printed in the U.S., whereas the European market and the international market had completely different stuff because it was not controlled by the same people.
Yes.
Same company, but like different markets. So he flew to Europe to the factories where he would buy like bulk European released Pez dispensers, smuggle them essentially back into the U.S.
So this is the other interesting
part.
Is there was no like definitive law because of their copyright thing.
Yeah.
So
basically when they registered,
technically it's not smuggling.
Yeah, when they registered their trademark, they failed to register it with the international customs like arm of the government, which is something you have to do to protect your trademark internationally, and things coming back into the country or out of the country. So they basically were like, well, their name's not on the books, so technically like you're fine to do this.
Yep.
Brought back thousands of Pez dispensers and began to sell them in the U.S. for lots of money. I mean, some of them were fetching up to like $1,200 for a Pez dispenser,
which
for
is like
rare.
What the fuck? It just brings me back to like the Beanie Baby craze. You know, it's like, what the fuck are these people doing?
Truly. So he starts doing this. The president of the company. They say that in the documentary.
Yeah.
So the president of Pez finds out and like tries to put an end to this, and there's all this back and forth. He ends up losing his connection in Europe, decides to manufacture one himself because you could through Pez. That was like, anyway, and then they stole the designs and started selling for a lower price and essentially put him out of business. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting story. Steve Glue as a person is also very interesting. Mm-hmm. Like, there is this, I mean, it is a story of him like stealing all this Pez, but it's also kind of a love story and a love letter to his wife, which is really sweet. You know, there's this kind of family supporting his family overarching theme.
I will say that it was a little bit hard at times to listen to her talk.
Yes, but
there were points where her voice got really like on the verge of like her losing her voice. Yeah. That I was like, oh.
And his wife now has Parkinson's, I think.
Yes.
So which is like part of that.
Mm-hmm.
But
yes, I'm very familiar.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed it. Again, it's in that kind of like vein of like McMillions and Pepsi, Where's My Jet?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like, it's kind of that same quirky.
It's absurdist. Yeah.
And what I loved is Steve Glue. They obviously interviewed him throughout the whole film, but he played himself in the reenactments, which is great. I love that. I absolutely love that. So
it's
they dyed his
back
beard.
To the original
and like,
Unsolved Mysteries, which, if you think about it,
right, yeah,
is so fucking traumatizing for the stories being told in Unsolved Mysteries.
I know,
but in this, it's fun.
It's great. It's great. Yeah, if you want something a little lighter, that's like a little more fun, really interesting story. It's an actual documentary, so it's like an hour and a half, I think.
Yeah, it's not like a 50-part.
No.
100-hour series.
No, it's a short story to tell. I do
short,
love that.
Sweet. It just was like Pez.
Like the German guy who was like, I think you're telling the story of the wrong guy. Like, you're talking about the wrong person.
He definitely is.
He's a weirdo. They're all weirdos.
He's a creep, a weirdo, and also definitely does everything illegally.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
the one that had like a secret stash.
Yeah, and he was, can we come up there and look? No.
Yeah,
no.
He was like, mm-mm. You can't look at anything. I can't tell you anything except for whatever directly relates to this tiny story.
Yeah. So that's The Pez Outlaw on Netflix. Check it out. This is that part of the show where we say content may not be appropriate for all listeners. We will be discussing, got a lot of sex stuff in mind.
So sorry if you're having puritanical feelings or whatever.
Yeah. But what are we talking about today, Jill?
Yeah. So we're going to be talking about, originally I was like, oh, I want to talk about like powerful ladies. But then we both were like, it's a sex cult. And then I'm like, I guess it's, we're talking about sex cults, really.
Yeah. Flashback to Dark Matters when we were standing outside and I got a text message from Tiff that changed everything.
And now enter the reenactment. No. We play ourselves.
I will be playing Vicky as Vicky in this reenactment.
So I was like, well, I guess we can make it about sex cults since we're both doing sex cults, oddly enough.
Yeah.
But we'll be talking about really powerful lady-led sex cults. So content warning if you don't want to hear about tantric sex and moaning and clitorises.
Yeah, it's a lot of sex talk today.
So much.
All the sex.
So mine will be taking place in an area of the United States where I think sex cults are mostly known, California. And we're going to be talking about the sex cult called One Taste, a.k.a. OM, or Orgasmic Meditation. Now,
okay,
you may have heard this and you may have seen the Netflix documentary that was out about it.
No, not until I saw it. I happened to glance at it in your notes and I was like, I kind of remember this, but I don't remember it like giving me that sort of like sex cult vibe when I looked at the little description. So now I feel like I have to go back and watch it.
Yeah. So Netflix got in trouble for their documentary.
Oops.
Yeah.
Well.
We'll talk all about it.
Okay.
So I watched the documentary and then I started reading more about it a while ago. So after the hype had calmed down, I thought we could take a peek at it in a different kind of capacity, I think, a little bit. Now, this one starts off as most cults do with, you know, quote unquote, good intentions. I actually went on their website because, believe it or not, it's still an organization.
Okay.
Even after the Netflix documentary and all of the lawsuits. The description that I'm going to read you is from the still active One Taste website. All right. Ready? Quote. One Taste was founded in 2005 with a mission to provide people with teaching and trainings into living a desire-based life rooted in a felt sense of connection.
Okay.
In its early days, it started out as a caravan retreat and operated as One Taste, an urban retreat center, until 2010. The company was run by a small, passionate group of practitioners living under one roof in San Francisco. From 2014 to 2017, the company expanded to become one of INC's 5,000 fastest growing companies with 5 licensed centers across the US and London and smaller outposts worldwide.
Okay.
By 2018, over 35,000 people have participated in our in-person events. Over 16,000 had taken classes and workshops. Over 1,300 completed our coaching program, and tens of thousands of people worldwide had learned to OM.
What?
I know, it's gross. There's so much more.
Have learned to own.
Now remember, this is on their website. In 2018, at the height of our success, we were canceled by salacious media mischaracterizations propagated by Bloomberg Businessweek, Playboy, Vice, BBC. It appears that these will be repeated on a forthcoming production on Netflix.
So they
haven't changed their website. The website kind of concludes with that information. It says, if you want to know more, here's more. Now, the organization is ran by a woman named Nicole Dadon. I always forget how to say her fucking last name. We're going to call her Nicole.
Okay.
She still has a semi-active LinkedIn page.
Okay.
And I wanted to pull from her own words on her LinkedIn page.
Part of me was like, did you message her?
No. I mean, she probably would respond. Because she
would or wouldn't?
She would. Oh. She is like crazy about getting back the reputation of this company. I went to her LinkedIn page because I just looked her up to try to find information about her and like her background and what's her deal. And so the first thing that popped up was her LinkedIn page. And I was like, this can't be for real. But it's for real. This is the description that's listed on the LinkedIn page where it like asks you to talk about yourself, your career path, your goals, blah, blah, blah. So this is written by her. The founder and chief executive officer of One Taste Incorporated graduated from San Francisco State University with a bachelor's degree in gender communications. In 1995, I founded 111 Minna Gallery, an avant-garde event space and gallery still thriving in San Francisco's SoMa community, which is south of Market. I served there as an owner for a year. In 2004, I launched One Taste, a San Francisco-based company that has pioneered what I have deemed the slow sex movement.
Okay.
It says she. It's in the third person,
gotcha.
But she wrote this. Yeah. As CEO, I oversee the entire corporate culture, which involves setting company policies, overseeing a team of 7 executive officers, and leading One Taste's public classes out of the Hilton Hotel.
What?
Yeah. The core of my unique practice is called orgasmic meditation, or OM for short, a practice involving 2 partners and taking 15 minutes. In this practice, a woman lies naked from the waist down and is stroked in a deliberate manner by her partner, usually male, in quotation marks. Unlike the typical sexual experience, the end result of OM practice is not necessarily climax, but a shared experience. In May of 2011,
oh my God,
I released my first book titled Slow Sex, The Art and Craft of the Female Orgasm. The book, which takes the female perspective as its focus, expounds and lengthens on the technique and philosophy of OM. Containing a 10-day OM starter program, my book also features exercises to improve other aspects of couples' sexual lives, including slow oral for him and her and slow intercourse. For my work on this book and as CEO of One Taste, I have been featured in such media outlets as the New York Times, Time.com, and NPR, among others.
There's a lot to unpack there.
Yep.
Okay. Can we go back to the Hilton Hotel thing?
Yeah, sure.
What is that?
So when you have conferences and workshops.
What did she write?
Leading One Taste public classes out of the Hilton Hotel.
Okay. I think, so when I heard it the first time, my brain was like leading people out of the hotel. And I was like, what the fuck does that even mean? But that makes, hearing it a second time, I'm like, okay, the words make sense in
so,
order now.
Yeah. So she's leading a workshop seminar, giving classes at the Hilton Hotel to the public. Yes. Which you still have to pay for. What does that mean?
Yeah.
So these are the words directly from Ohm, directly from her. And how they perceive themselves and how they say what they do is what they do.
Right? She really put it out there like, this is for straight couples.
Oh, 1,000%.
Very heteronormative. Like,
1,000,000%. She talks about male empowerment. This is a misogynistic practice.
Gross.
It's 1,000% for the man.
Yeah.
And she keeps saying it's for the woman. It's not.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah. Ugh.
Especially when we hear about what happens later.
Oh, God.
Okay. So there's a lot of people who state that One Taste is like a pyramid scheme type kind of program and that participants are involved in sex trafficking, prostitution, and they violate labor laws. So those are the big issues that have come up and have been mentioned in the Netflix documentary and in a lot of the articles that I took from. Now, they mentioned the salacious things from Bloomberg. And I have put a lot of information from the original Bloomberg article that came out in 2018 that was the impetus of what Netflix did.
Okay.
They're the ones who came out and talked to people from One Taste originally and discussed all of the issues. So a lot of this information is from that particular article. Now, One Taste was created to bring kind of like mindfulness to partner relationships through sexual touch. And the goal was to create a oneness. So that's why it's called One Taste, which, honest to God, every time I hear it, I think it's like a Pampered Chef company.
I know. I hate that
name. I feel like we're going to be making dips.
Yeah. Well, because it Tastefully Simple, calls to mind is like One Taste.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, this is about seasoning.
It's about seasoning.
It's not.
It's never about seasoning.
So back to their website, they say that this is steeped in a scientific practice. So I'm going to read the quote-unquote scientific basis for which they are trying to get people to do this, okay?
Okay.
So this is from their website. Science is confirming that practitioners of OHM have known for years, OHM has enormous benefits to physical, mental, and emotional health. 6 peer-reviewed IRB-approved studies have been performed to date, with results still emerging. Some of the top findings include, here's where it gets wackadoo, mystical experiences on par with moderate psilocybin dosage. Researchers administered the mystical experience questionnaire to 780 respondents about OHM and found that it equates to the second highest dose of psilocybin. Remarkably, in OHM, you are only tapping into your neurobiology without the use of any substance. Okay, so they're equating this practice to taking a mushroom trip.
I'm going to guess that this research is heavily flawed.
Oh, 1,000,000%.
No double. I'm going to assume it's not like a double blind or like unbiased.
This is nonsense. They're talking nonsense. And they're like, these peer-reviewed. Okay, first of all, the participants in the studies it's being conducted by the Institute and not by a third party. And then it's being reviewed by a third party. Okay, so that is not how you do that.
But also, how do you measure mystical effects?
With a questionnaire, obviously.
Obviously.
You're not taking heart rates or reactions as it's happening. No, it's a survey after finished. Based on a study of over 125 pairs, OHM has been observed to in psychedelics, research are this is on their website. It makes no sense. Okay. In psychedelics, researchers are discussing tapping into post-traumatic growth, where trauma is transformed into positive growth. Research on OHM suggests something similar. That sentence doesn't make sense. And this is on their website. So I wanted to pull that because I'm like, huh?
Yeah.
OHM evokes strong changes in the emotional regulation centers in the brain. There are a number of brain changes that occur in OHM, and these are likely associated with the spiritual elements of the practice. Based on a study of over 125 pairs of OHM, has observed increased closeness in both romantic and non-romantic partners.
Also, 125 pairs. That's only 250. Yeah. That's not very many.
No. A higher level of post-ohm closeness was seen in non-romantic partners. Closeness may be a result of sharing in a positive experience. Benefits such as closeness may be more sustainable in your practice of ohm more frequently, and closeness can be improved after just one ohm. So that's just a couple of little snippets about this quote-unquote scientific...
It's very arbitrary terms. Oh, it's like closeness.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
You're physically close.
Yeah. Again, I'm assuming like it's a questionnaire. Like, do you feel closer to your partner?
Yeah. Also, you're experiencing something sexual together.
Yeah.
So you literally have to be close.
Yeah. Oh my God. Okay.
Anyway, so ohm and one taste really focus on a mindful practice in which the meditation is finger to genital touching, specifically stimulation of a female. Ohm is practiced in pairs with one practitioner stroking the female while both focus their attention on the sensation when the stated goal of developing a connective resonance between the pairs occurs.
Okay.
So...
I'm just going to accept that this is all nonsense and not question, because otherwise we will never get through this.
Yeah. It's you know, oh my God. If you want to do the tantric sex thing, if you want to do slow, okay, great, fine, perfect, whatever. I find that to be incredibly boring. But
yeah,
I don't think you need someone to tell you how to do it. I think we pretty much understand how our bodies work, and you could do that on your own.
Yeah.
You don't need an entire room of people watching someone do that on stage.
That's weird.
Because that's what happens.
That's weird.
So Nicole has described her work as, quote, one that places a near exclusive emphasis on women's pleasure in which love, romance, and even flirtation are not required. After, both partners discuss their experiences verbally. Now, women's pleasure, which love, romance, and even flirtation are not required. Okay. When you are learning this in their scenarios, you are forcibly put with somebody.
This is what I was imagining. Just like pairing you off with.
You don't get to pick who is touching you.
Oof.
And this is where the problem starts.
Right.
This is why I don't believe this is a feminist practice at all, as she claims. Because you're forcing a woman to be physical with someone she doesn't know. And it really is against her will.
Yeah.
You signed up for this workshop, yes.
Yeah.
But you should have choice.
Yeah, right.
So they kind of state that the practice is steeped in yoga, meditation, and tantric sex practices. And like, sure, physical touch, it does have like positive effects on people.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I mean, how slow sex we got to have to like achieve a closeness? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or like, at the top, they like talk about trauma a lot, which is the biggest trigger points for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Like, sexual trauma is a huge issue.
Right.
And this could be traumatizing and re-traumatizing for a lot of people, especially if you don't get to select who you are being touched by.
That's so fucked up. Bizarre.
So this is an excerpt from the Bloomberg expose article where this cult was shoved into the spotlight. Again, this is from 2018, so you can look up the entire thing. I took a decent amount out of it, but it is like 12 pages.
Okay.
So they do an amazing job, and they really pull up a lot of info. So Bloomberg Businessweek interviewed 16 former One Taste staffers and community members. So staffers are the ones who are in charge of kind of doing a lot of the workshops. Nicole doesn't actually do that many workshops.
Of course not.
Some were involved like right when the article was coming out. So they were anonymous. They signed non-disclosure agreements. And there was a little bit of fear that there would be some retribution. So some asked the article to withhold their name. So you can actually see people who have called out their names and some who have not. So you can actually, there's one person in particular that they discuss in this article, and they've been interviewed and have written other articles. So you can look at their stuff a little bit more.
Okay.
So ohm has strict rules, and it is supposed to be separate from sex, meaning it is not foreplay. The pitch to women is 15 minutes of meditative focus only on their pleasure and sensation, with no obligations to reciprocate. Men are told it will help them learn to be more sensitive to women's needs through Although former members say it's often strongly implied that fellow 1T students will be open to sexual experimentation beyond OM. So basically saying that the reciprocation is actually expected.
Okay.
Many students' first encounters are casual. They spot a free or almost free event with a title such as Tired of Swiping Left? Let's Talk Real Intimacy. Or You Do Yoga? You Meditate? Now Try Orgasmic Meditation. At the event, 1T staffers tell them about the $199 introduction to OM class, so $200.
$200.
You can have an OM. While attendees are no longer invited to try OM during the intro class, because they used to.
Just like get whoever off the street and be like, let's do OM.
Take your pants down. Like that. They used to do that. And
this
they
makes
stopped.
It feels so gross.
Doesn't it? Like, yeah. It is disgusting. It is so not female-centered, no. And I don't know how they're like, oh, it is. It still features, although they don't do the You Don't OM, it still features an OM demonstration between staffers right before lunch.
Yeah, that's
so
what
you're
I
here for a whole day. You're talking
right
OM
before lunch.
You're gonna watch two people on stage in front of you perform this, and then go to lunch, and then talk about how you could do it yourself.
This is not for
Are
me.
The demonstrations in person really necessary?
I don't know. Visual
I
learners?
See lots of pelvic floor therapists with their fake vaginas.
Yeah, right.
You don't need a real person.
No. No.
Anyway. So the only way to learn more past the intro is to take additional classes. Students pay $499 a weekend course, $4,000 for a treat, $12,000 for a coaching program, and $16,000 for an intensive.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. I know.
Gross.
I know.
Gross.
In 2014, One Taste started selling a year-long $60,000 membership program.
$60,000 a year?
A year. Which lets buyers take all the courses they want and sit in the front row. Because, again, they're doing live demonstrations. Staff also encourages students to repeat courses, telling them the experience changes as they progress. This is the pyramid scheme.
Scientology.
Mm-hmm.
Take courses over and over again.
Exactly. One Taste says that about 1,400 people have taken the coaching program, 6,500 have come into just the intro class, and more than 14,000 have signed up for the online courses and their app.
Okay. Damn, I hear stuff like that, and I'm like, I wish I had $60,000 to just throw away. Like,
it's California.
Honestly, like, if you have that much disposable income, like,
go fuck yourself, first of all.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure you got bigger problems to worry about than
yeah
your OM.
I mean, they probably don't OM. They probably have a very boring life. Now, some students do take a course or two and then, like, never come back. But often those who are, like, really into it are – they're drawing from people who have anxiety or are trying to resolve sexual trauma.
Of course.
That's their target, which is so fucking disgusting. If you volunteer at events, a lot of times it will – they will, like, bring you into the fold and ask you to work for the company full-time, usually in sales. Former staff members have said that they were trained to target young, beautiful women and awkward, wealthy tech guys.
Of course.
Of course.
That's not – I mean, this all tracks.
Mm-hmm. They set up booths at life hacking conferences and early morning dance parties, serving coffee and shirts with slogans like the pussy nose and asking passerbys, how's your orgasm?
I really don't want to.
I
just want to be going about my day.
Someone would ask me down the street. I'd be like, damn, girl, it's off the hook. And they'd be like, well, fuck.
How's yours?
How's yours? It sounds like you don't actually climax.
Oh, my God.
Ugh.
It's all
right?
Gross.
This entire thing is cringe, and I'm so sorry.
Yeah, it is. I'm in full cringe, like, this whole episode. Mm-hmm. Every time you say OM, I'm like, ooh.
Yeah, I know. Ugh. It also just bastardizes, you know, like, actual real meditative OM.
Yeah.
It's so, ugh.
Yeah.
At One Taste events, attendees often play communication games, prompting them to share vulnerable stories. Former staff members say that they took notes that might help them sell this to people later while they're listening to these vulnerable stories. They're really focusing on things like divorce, people saying that they have loneliness, that sort of thing. And they really listen if somebody says something about their wealth.
Of course.
Of course. They also say female employees were told to wear lipstick, heels, and short black skirts to be more tempting to passerbys to come into the classes. One-taste teachings were often used to justify sexual manipulation and abuse. Several former members say aversion practices is the company's teaching, that you gain power and expand your orgasm. Within the group, a broad term for sexual energy, by performing sexual acts you don't want to do or doing them with people you find disgusting.
Oh, God.
So, yup. You, like I said, are not selecting the people. Yeah. And even if you say, that person's giving me the creeps. They're like, oh, so sorry. You're going to have to own with them.
Even more reason for you to own with that person.
Right? You need to get past that. A real girl boss lets anyone touch them. That's what they would say.
Yeah. This is, I mean, we have seen so, by this, obviously, the year 2023, like, mm-hmm. we've seen so many regular cults, sex cults, all this kind of manipulation. Yep. You know, there's things like, that are giving me very Scientology vibes, a lot of NXIVM vibes, where it's like, oh, and even like Teal Swan, where it's like, well, this sounds like a you problem, and this is something that you need to overcome. So by overcoming that, you're going to do exactly what you are saying you don't want to do. Like, can we chill on that and just let people, like, not
just go to regular therapy, people, please.
Yes,
for the love of God.
Yes, yes.
Just go to regular therapy.
Just get therapy.
If you want to, like, regular meditate, go off.
Right.
If you want to talk to somebody about sexual, like, trauma and stuff, go to a regular therapist for the love of fucking God.
Yes. 10 out of 10 would recommend therapy.
In 2015, the company paid $325,000 to settle a labor dispute with a former sales rep. According to some people whose names are complicated to say. they stated that others ordered her to sleep with customers and managers, and two people familiar with the matter say she considered the experience sexual assault. So it came up as a labor dispute, but the reality is they were telling this person to fuck customers to keep them in the program.
Oof. Ugh. That's a hard pass for me, gotta say.
Former staffers say that there were multiple cases of domestic violence between employees in relationships, which were sometimes characterized as one partner letting out his or her aggressive desire, aka known as the beast. Now, this comes up in the documentary. She talks about men's male aggression as their inner beast, okay? In one case, an executive repeatedly slapped his girlfriend during a 2014 fight in the company's Market Street headquarters in front of employees. The executive was fired, but since has been rehired.
What?
Yep, we'll come back to the beast part, trust me. Live at the Ohm House was relentlessly scheduled, so they were constantly being told where to go, what to do constantly. So when you were at the headquarters, they called the Ohm House, you could also live in their like company apartments, which were attached to it.
Okay.
So this is kind of a breakdown of the day in the life of somebody who worked for this company. Every morning at 7 a.m., staff convened for two rounds of Ohm, switching partners midway through. Then came an AA-inspired fear inventory where you were writing out and sharing your worries with your partner. Former staffers say that they were encouraged to report to management if they heard others express doubts about One Taste. They all then went to Vikram Yoga, cooked, cleaned, then spent several hours making sales calls around a table, tracking their progress with Salesforce, which is like a really popular use like CRM program.
Oh, yeah.
After an afternoon round of Ohm, they left to run evening public sessions. So they were Ohming three times in a day.
Wow.
And like working, doing yoga, cooking, cleaning the entire facility, like all this in one day. So obviously more than an 8-hour workday.
Yeah, yeah. And this, I mean, this goes to not only just like controlling the time, but controlling how much sleep people have, the times that they're able to eat. Mm-hmm. Like, this is all control.
Yep, all classic cult.
Mm-hmm.
Classic cult. Mm-hmm. So after this 2018 Bloomberg expose, The FBI announced that it was going to be probing One Taste, which is a poor choice of words. Oof. Later that year, a former member filed a lawsuit claiming sexual abuse and fraud. It was dismissed by a judge.
Really?
This is really, really common because they, like, don't allow you to record. They don't allow you to, like, have a lot of personal effects or anything like that. So it's very hard to get, like, real hard information about what's happening and, like, the abuse and everything. So yeah. There have been very few lawsuits that have actually gone through.
Damn.
The case against One Taste began to ramp up after the Netflix documentary was released in November of 2022. The doc went into a great deal about the organization and the allegations against them, and they interviewed several former members and some who were still currently in it. Now, in the documentary, they went on to describe the borderline predatory practices during the workshops. The man-to-woman ratio is where the issue was also. So it skewed heavily towards male attendants in the workshops for obvious fucking reasons.
Right. Oh, I'm not surprised.
I only have to pay $400 to touch a woman?
Right.
Hell yeah.
Right.
So many men, in fact, that if there wasn't enough women in the workshop, One Taste salespeople would have to volunteer themselves to own with somebody else. Because there weren't enough female participants.
Okay.
So you're forcing your staff to participate in sex acts because you don't have enough participants in your workshop.
Ugh. Gross.
It is a known and proven fact and also brought up in the documentary that many men were attending expecting just to have sex.
Well, especially when you're doing it in those intro classes, like before they changed, right? Yep. Like,
it was gross and negligent the amount of men they allowed into the workshops without interviewing or background checks or just because the sheer number of men be like, oh, you know what? We don't have enough. What they should have done is like, we don't have enough participants. We'll schedule you for a different workshop. Instead of forcing your staff to do this every single time.
Right.
The leader, Nicole, even described her feelings towards sexual trauma, molestation, and rape in the documentary. This is where the beast comes back into play. Now, she shared with classes that she didn't. So her mother was like not really there, and her father was a convicted child molester, and she was raped and sexually assaulted throughout her entire youth.
Okay.
According to her.
Okay.
Now there are some allegations that she was never actually touched. Mm-hmm. There are also some conflicting stories, and then there are some stories where she kind of says things like she was abducted and like all of these other extra things.
Do you feel like it might be like, because I could totally see this being like a recovered memory.
Yes. Deal. 1000%. Okay. I think it's more on the borderline of that.
Okay.
I'm not saying that maybe she was molested, but her stories got progressively more sensational as the company got bigger. And I think if she was assaulted, she's embellishing a lot to make it seem more things happened to her, and this is how she recovered herself, basically. Now, she shared with her classes that she didn't think that her father, who was charged with 52 counts of child molestation.
52? Holy shit.
She said that she didn't think he was a bad person. He's not a bad person. She described predatory men as having inner beasts. Now, when that former member was sexually assaulted by multiple men, we brought up earlier, she was told by Nicole to ignore her body's response to the assault. And quote, this is what she was told. I was reprimanded afterwards for showing fear in the face of his beast. Okay. A true turned on woman would have taken his beast's cry for help with grace and love.
Okay. So you're just making excuses for men to assault women.
Yes. So what she's saying, and this is how she thinks that her father's not a bad man, is that when a man wants to rape a woman or beat her, it's because his inner beast is not being cared for and taken care of. And that it is a man's desire to always have sex and to always be in charge. And when he's not, that's when he lashes out.
So it's the woman's fault.
Yep.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, makes sense feminist. To me.
How feminist.
Oh, God. Oh, this is so bad. It's so bad.
Yep. Now, in November of 2020, BBC Radio released a BBC Radio 4 released a 10-part documentary podcast entitled The Orgasm Cult. I have not listened to it as of yet.
Ooh, BBC does some good podcasts,
but I really want to. Yeah. I didn't want to have too much podcast documentary in my brain. That's why I waited a significant time. Yeah. Because I want the words to be for me.
I'm gonna check that
so
out.
So definitely check that out. But from their description, they spoke with former workers of the company to look at allegations of emotional, financial, and sexual abuse. They also really go into a part of the conversation that I feel is not discussed in the documentary or the Bloomberg article, and they are talking about the PTSD and the trauma that was caused to these people. So if you want to really, really deep dive into the whole thing and really hear about individualized stories and experiences, I would definitely check this out. It
just
also
added it to my list.
Yeah, it talks about the PTSD, which I think is the major part that people are fucking missing.
Yeah.
They're trying to get at this company because of like more of the money, right? When it should be like a federal case or like a state case against them.
Right.
All of these little, you know, cases that they're trying to build are really about individuals when they should all come together and as an entity and talk about it's sexual assault, it's sex trafficking, the labor laws a little bit too, but that's really how they should approach this to take down the company. Now, since the documentary and the podcast, One Taste has changed its name to the Institute of Ohm.
Okay.
And the company assets were then bought by someone else, but Nicole is still in charge.
So they're trying to hide the money.
Yes. Okay. the organization is still active and running. And this is from a December 2022 article right after the Netflix documentary came out. The quotes are taken from her giving a workshop to an audience of about 50 or 60 people. And the workshop was called Women Over Dinner, and it took place in Los Angeles, and it included loyal participants, friends, and journalists who were invited to the relaunch of the Ohm Institute. Quote, "I'm the captain of a ship, so if anybody's hurt, I want to know. I want to know everything. That would happen on my watch, it's anathema to everything I believe." I think she did not say the right word. She goes on, "I was hit by a bomb, and that bomb was called canceled, and I was thrown under my desk. I was vomiting and shaking and crying and self-pitying and scared. I'm a brave woman, and I did not know that that kind of terror existed. My phone overnight went from 2,400 people to 40. First of all, why the fuck do you have 2,400 people on your phone?
Yeah, that's
psycho.
A lot.
She said, "My agent at the time, I wouldn't touch you with a 10-foot pole. I did not know what it meant to be an untouchable human being, and then I did. And then there were some people, some teachers, some guides, some really rare and fearless friends that said, 'Get up and come on. We're going to do the science. We're going to write this book.' I didn't know if I ever wanted to come out again. It's a lot to face after you read things. Someone inadvertently sent me an article once which said, 'Messianic cult leader' about me." She said that... She said, quote, "It turned into a California wildfire, which resulted in what we loosely call a documentary." I'll start talking about Netflix.
Oh, my God.
So as of now, the FBI probe has not moved forward. They're still in the investigation phases. I think that they, like, are being cautious because the Netflix documentary came out. And so now they're like, oh, you know, like that's
the company or the FBI?
The FBI.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I think that is still somewhat active, but there's not any more information about it.
And so a lot of those things go on in the background too, where it's like seems like nothing is happening, and then one day they'll be like, "Well, we have an announcement in this case," and it's
A lot of people who haven't come forward, and there's a lot of people who remain anonymous. There's a lot of people who also have had non-disclosure agreements that they've had to sign. So there's a lot of hurdles and red tape.
Yeah.
The organization is still active, albeit far from the numbers they once saw. And currently, there are no other lawsuits against the organization, although this may change. By the time this podcast comes out, there are some rumblings about a lawsuit, a class action labor lawsuit.
Ooh.
So I'm excited for that.
That'll be interesting.
And hopefully that happens because this is a predatory organization.
Yeah.
I don't know necessarily so much a cult as it is sex trafficking.
Yeah. Yeah.
When you are forcing people to participate in sex acts against their will because it's quote unquote their job, you're no different than a pimp. I'm so sorry.
Right.
But that is One Taste.
I had no idea.
The Institute of Ohm.
That's wild.
Whatever they're called now.
That is a lot.
Once again, we are so sorry, but this episode is sex heavy and not sex positive. It is sex negative. Yes. It is anti-sex.
So as we said earlier, I got a tip.
Mm-hmm. A tip.
For what I wanted to, I didn't even know at the time, but I was like, this sounds really good. We changed what our episode was about. So I'm going to talk about the Oneida community.
Okay.
And John Humphrey Noyes.
Ooh.
This is a very strange. Have you heard of that guy?
I have.
Have you?
I have.
Very weird dude.
Yeah. There's a lot of predatory things coming to light the past year or so about a lot of people and a lot of organizations. So.
Yeah.
Yep.
So we're going to go way, way back to the 1800s. Mm-hmm. So John Humphrey Noyes was born September 3rd, 1811. He grew up in a pretty well-to-do family. His father, whose name was also John, went to college at Dartmouth before becoming a congressman. And his mother, Polly, was described as a, quote, strong-willed and deeply religious woman. A lot of places talked about how, like, she very much wanted to put the fear of God in her kids. And hoped that one of them would become like a preacher or something along those lines. But honestly, at the time when he was growing up, Noyes was not really interested in anything religious or like theology related. In 1826, Noyes opted to attend Dartmouth University like his father. And during this time, so there's a lot of things going on at this time. There's this revivalist movement that had taken off. And we're talking like the old like tent style revivals. This was just, I think it was just before or just at the beginning of the Second Great Awakening. So like there's this huge religious movement happening in the United States. Charles Grandison Finney was one of these guys that was kind of like leading the charge. He was a big, well-known preacher. But it would be another 5 years before Noyes, at the behest of his mother, attended a four-day revival meeting in Putney. 4 days, which I'm like, this is wild.
It's too much.
It's too much. So this was in Putney, Vermont, and it was led by Charles Grandison Finney. Now, according to the Oneida community by Randall Hillebrand, quote, at first he was not moved by what he heard, but after the meeting, he suffered a feverish cold, which led him to think of death and to humble himself before God.
There was a movie that we watched recently that took a lot of its characters from a bunch of these tent revivals. And that's why I knew this guy's name, because one of the characters was loosely based on him and like one other person.
Yeah.
But it was just funny because like, in the article that I read about the it was like they called it a surreal documentary style movie. And I was like, what the fuck does that mean? but they were like, this is starting to come back again. And then it started naming a bunch of other like recent tent revival style culty things. And I'm like, oh my God.
Yeah. Well, there was the one that just made the news recently for like a week long prayer session in like, I want to say it was like Virginia.
And bringing snakes back into it is coming back again. God. Like there's like it's so
that
crazy.
Never went away. That just like,
but like in popularity now it's becoming more like open. Like even though it's illegal in a lot of the states that they're doing it in, they're like, nope, we have snakes.
Yeah,
like, so it's kind of crazy, like the cyclical nature of how everything is coming.
And during this time too, especially, it was very like fire brimstone, like you know, crazy type revivals. He got swept up in that and converted essentially to Christianity. Crazy. Christianity kind of.
Quote unquote.
We're going to say kind of, yeah.
Christianity question mark?
So Noyes actually decided to go on to attend Yale Theological Seminary.
Well, okay.
So he was like, he did the Dartmouth thing. He was like, all right, I'm going to go become a preacher. And while he was studying at Yale, made the biggest discovery of Christianity ever.
okay. Since the Bible.
Yes, since the Bible. So he had actually been doing this research on the date of the second coming of Jesus Christ.
Oh, Jesus.
And he found what he claimed to be evidence that it had already happened. So they were he was saying, according to his research, that the second coming of Jesus actually happened in 70 AD. And
that's real quick.
So the time that they were living in, like the time that we're living in, is like this post second coming.
New wave coming.
Yeah.
Fourth wave coming.
Yeah. So it was at this point that Noyes completely changed his understanding of salvation, which he called perfectionism. Okay.
Okay.
And so the main thrust of this doctrine was that you are free from sin at the moment of conversion. Something that was kind of like really frowned upon in traditional circles. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, they had these baptism things, but there was also like confessional and this idea that you had to continuously be forgiven for your sins because you're sinning all the time. And we'll talk about this a little bit more later, but Noyes was essentially saying the minute you convert, because you're choosing to humble yourself before God, you are free from sin from that moment on. And everything else that you do is not sinful because it's made with a clean heart. Like those decisions are made with a clean heart and a clean mind under God. So like,
okay, I can see that.
Okay. Which is kind of problematic when you're talking about like taking responsibility for your actions. But
yes. But also, I think what he was like getting at is like, well, if you really did accept Jesus, you wouldn't be doing any of those acts anyway. But we all know that's not how it works. True. That's not how it works.
So again, this is from the Oneida Community article, quote, "It is said that one of the reasons that Noyes adopted this doctrine was the fact that he could not believe that he was a sinner since he could not summon up from within any feeling of deep guilt and despair."
That sounds like a personality problem.
In 1983, Noyes married Harriet Holton, although they started living, so they didn't break up, but they started living separately in 1844.
Okay.
So I'm going to remind you occasionally and our listeners that this is like Victorian times. Mm-hmm. So like,
yeah,
a lot of this shit is like very frowned upon.
I mean, so like if you are rich, that was like that's copacetic because you have multiple houses and you're a businessman. Mm-hmm. But if you're not rich,
true,
that is not a thing.
So in the lead up to the creation of Oneida, Noyes became ostracized from his friends, who began to think that he was like kind of unhinged.
Members, you don't say.
Members of the Yale Theological Seminary began to call him a heretic for his beliefs. But again, like none of this mattered to Noyes because he claimed that since he had completely surrendered to God's will, that all of his choices were made, that he made were perfect because they came from a perfect heart. Okay, this is what I'm talking about. Like all my choices are totally cool with God because like my heart is perfect and clean.
Right? So pure, so fresh and so clean.
So fresh and so clean. He also thought that his new devotion to God canceled out any prior obligations to traditional religion and just did whatever the fuck he wanted to without any regret or like or regard for his consequences at all. However, the consequences came swiftly.
All right.
Because Yale decided to revoke his license to preach and expelled him from the school.
I didn't know that you had like a license to preach.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously, like being, it's depending on what religion you're in and all that sort of stuff, like being ordained or being certified or whatever. But like that can be revoked by the religious organization that you serve. Yeah.
It's bananas.
Not even by the school, by like a religious organization, but just being like canceled.
Now you can just go on the internet and get one from a random
you person. Could and then nobody gives a fuck.
Nobody can tell you how to preach.
So Noyes decided to return to Putney, Vermont, where he began to cultivate this community. So he said, fuck Yale, I'm gonna continue to preach. kept on preaching. He started the Putney Bible School in 1836 and then turned it into a communal organization in 1844, sharing the idea, which basically shared the ideals of the later Oneida iteration of the community, which we'll talk about in a few minutes. So one of the main tenets was complex marriage, or free love, as it's more widely known, which is essentially like not having one dedicated partner, being able to kind of have sex or have relations with
anarchy.
But it was clear that Noyes was an active participant because in 1847 he was arrested for adultery.
They don't understand my religious beliefs.
He was released pending trial, and then, like, in the meantime, discovered that the police were also looking for some of his followers. So they decided,
like, girlfriends, looking for his girlfriend. Yeah.
So they decided to pick up and leave and head to Oneida, New York, where they had this connection to another perfectionist with this huge amount of land. So Noyes decided to settle there. And they built their first communal dwelling in 1848, officially becoming the Oneida community. So when they had first left Vermont, Noyes had 45 followers, although this would grow to 87 by the end of 1848. So first, I want to talk about their belief system.
Okay.
There were 10 main doctrines that the community sort of abided by. So first was complex marriage, where every man and every woman is married to each other. They could engage in sexual intercourse, but they weren't, like, attached to anybody in particular. Male continence was another big one, which essentially is, or was at the time, like a form of birth control where the man would not ejaculate during or after sexual intercourse. So, like, they could have sex, but, like, he wasn't able to ejaculate at all. He just didn't.
How'd that work?
He just didn't.
Just pinch it off. Don't let it happen.
Not to say, I mean, not to say there weren't accidents.
Oh no!
And which, you know, caused some, like, accidental births within the community. Mm-hmm. But a lot of this stemmed from, like, in the early years, they didn't really have the financial side of things figured out. And so they were really trying not to bring more children into the community that they then had to support. So they told the males to practice male continence, and just, like, you know, just don't come inside. It's basically what they were getting at. The third one is ascending fellowship, which is pretty problematic. So this is where the young virgins in the community were brought.
This is where the problem starts. Okay.
Were brought into the practice of complex marriage. Generally speaking, it was the older, more godly members who were.
I'm getting touches of Mormonism in here.
They would basically, like, pick a virgin that they were responsible for spiritually and then kind of bring them into the complex marriage. And it normally happened when they were around 14 years old.
Oh, my God.
Yes. Yes.
Oh, my God.
The fourth main one is mutual criticism. Which
that sounds vaguely familiar.
Yeah, which is essentially going before the community and being reprimanded in front of a bunch of people and then having everybody else, like,
roast me.
Yeah. Basically,
roast me in front of this congregation. All the shit that
they don't like. Yeah. There was confession, but they didn't. It wasn't like giving confession. It was the idea that no confession was needed because once you joined the community, you were free from sin. Yes. Number six, regeneration. That Christ's death was not for the sins of man, but was the first blow to Satan. But that believing in the death of Christ, one was released from sin because Christ destroyed the central cause of sin. So, again, it's this idea of, like,
so many gymnastics. He didn't. I said it in my brain.
He didn't. He didn't. Christ did not die for your sins, but died as a way to defeat Satan. And so, because of that.
He went down swinging on Satan. Got it.
But because you believe that he died for sin, then it releases you from your sin? Again, mental gymnastics.
Yeah, that hurt my brain.
They had this idea of separation, not necessarily, like, in different parts of the community, but separation sexually. So not having sex. not having sex. It's very, this...
I'm confused.
Yeah, we'll get there.
I'm so confused. Are we fucking or are we not fucking? What's happening?
So it's basically, and I think I touched on this a little bit later, but it's basically like having... You can have relations with whoever. It's this idea of free love, but like you're not just having sex to have sex. Also, mm-hmm. like you're having sex for a purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So not it's not children. Just like free. Well, later it is children. Later it is children.
I'm so confused.
In the beginning, it wasn't children because they were broke.
It's for your godliness.
Yeah.
Okay.
But also magnets. We'll get there. We'll get there.
You're having sex for magnets or about magnets or around magnets.
Yes.
Okay, all of that. Okay.
They also had this sort of equality of men and women. I say sort of because this is still like Victorian times. So
equal as it could get.
Yeah. Generally speaking, women were like staying at home, taking care of the children, bearing the children. They were not educated. They were, this is pre-women's rights. And in the Oneida community, men and women, for the most part, worked side by side. So, like, men would be doing laundry right next to women. They'd mm-hmm. be cooking right next to women. There were some of these, like, household things that did still kind of fall to women to do mm-hmm. primarily, but they were also allowed to work outside of the home, which was huge in the 1800s. And then finally, the last one is the millennial kingdom. Again, this is the idea that Jesus had actually introduced the millennial kingdom in 70 AD when the second coming actually happened, don't you know?
Oh,
yes. So again, I just really quickly want to touch on like the role of women in the community. They, like I said, they were kind of like viewed as these homemakers, childbearers. So actually living in this communal situation was kind of beneficial in a way. I'm not praising it in any means, but like it was...
mutually
kind of progressive beneficial. In the community because women were allowed to cut their hair shorter because it made working easier. They were allowed to wear bloomer style clothing, so pants.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able to explore like careers and industries outside of the household, but a lot of the household duties were still like falling to women mm-hmm. to do. Because men.
Yeah.
They don't know how to wash dishes.
Yeah, I don't know how to do all of that.
There's also another practice that we have to talk about. Called the Oneida Stirpiculture Experiment.
Say that word again?
Stirpiculture.
Stirpiculture.
Yeah, S-T-I-R-P-I culture.
Okay.
Stirpiculture.
All right.
So between 1869 and 1879, Oneida conducted the first positive eugenics experiment in American history.
Didn't roll back that tape.
Bet you didn't think eugenics was going to come up.
Positive eugenics?
Yeah.
Those don't go together.
You might be asking, what the heck the difference is?
Yeah. So all eugenics is bad, okay?
Yeah. So eugenics is essentially like the control... I don't want to say controlling the population. It is producing population that is the most ideal. That's like the idea behind eugenics
designed.
Generally. Yeah, exactly. Positive eugenics was basically encouraging people with desirable traits to breed mm-hmm. in order to produce offspring that was more desirable.
Mm-hmm.
Quote Nazis. Unquote. Yeah. Yeah. Because I think
very
a lot
Nazi oriented.
A lot of times when you hear about eugenics, it's more eliminating population, mm-hmm. like forced sterilization, forced euthanasia, like that kind of thing. But this is kind of the other side where it's like, we want these people to have sex and have kids because spiritually they're on another level, you know, mentally, intellectually, they're like the perfect humans, and if they breed, then they're gonna breed a perfect human.
Mm-hmm.
Very Nazi.
I mean, yeah, Hitler had that all figured out decades
mm-hmm.
later.
Mm-hmm.
His Hitler Youth program was to raise up the next generation, and they were literally like creating marriage contracts for children.
Yeah. not great
at all.
So this is kind of like off of the back of the male continence deal. Noyes actually advocated for intentional reproduction rather than just having sex for sex's sake, right? Like, mm-hmm. so you wanted to have intentional sex where you were doing it to reproduce these offspring. So basically, Noyes put together a committee of men and women who would put partners together that they viewed with like superior spiritual and mental qualities.
Okay.
Some of the couples applied. So you were able to like apply with you and your partner to like get permission to breed, essentially.
Ew. Okay.
But there were a lot of couples that were put together by this committee. Many of them happen to be older men with younger women.
Always.
Mm. The experiment resulted in 58 children.
Holy shit.
13 of which were accidental male continents.
But yeah, we wanted to have children.
Yeah, but not those people. Only specific people.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah, okay.
Were so like not granted matched. Permission.
Yeah, yeah. Not matched people.
They were like the lower quality child.
They were the B team.
Yes. And all of these children were raised communally. And
it's so confusing. Yeah. I'd be like, who can I actually have a child with?
Yeah. And when you're talking about raising children community, they pretty much let the child stay with the mother until like 15 months, I think, mm-hmm. at which point they were kind of weaned off and separated from their parents, where you had the children all living together in sort of their own separate housing. And certain people that were considered like the mothers and fathers of the community taking care of these children and establishing what they considered an appropriate relationship with their mother and or father. Again, this is going to come up later.
So
like
a distant one.
Some of these, because of this free love system, like some of these women had children with multiple fathers. Again, in the 1800s, like this is all not good.
Yeah.
Noyes also had some more scientific ideas that totally give me L. Ron Hubbard vibes.
Quote unquote scientific ideas.
Big, yeah. He actually didn't really like shy away from this idea that Christianity and science worked hand in hand. Like they kind of went together. So he had a fascination with magnetism and electricity.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Is he wearing magnet bracelets?
No, they didn't have them, I don't think.
Not yet.
Back then. Not yet. The balance bracelets.
Right, yeah.
So this is from Lisa Hucks for Collectors Weekly, quote, he asserted that Christ's love was an electric fluid that could be passed through words, both written and spoken, as well as through touch. But the ultimate way to charge up the community's God battery was through sex. And if the members had enough electric sex in the name of Jesus, they could achieve immortality on earth, end quote.
I'm so confused by the practices of this place. And also, like, electric fluid sounds like a 60s jam magnets. Band or something. I don't know.
Magnets, man. What did they do? How did they work? Sex. Sex is the answer. Electric sex for Jesus.
Oh, my God. That sounds like an amazing band name.
It's a great band name. Electric sex for Jesus. So... I'm going to say there's a lot more wild shit I'm skipping over because...
Good, because I'm already confused.
Yeah. I would definitely recommend that you look into this because it gets pretty crazy with some of the beliefs that Noyes had. But the community needed governance and a way to bring in money and bring in revenue. So the government was set up with 21 standing committees and 48 administrative departments.
Okay.
At its height, Oneida had around 300 members to work in the various industries that provided its revenue. So due to the substantial amount of land that the community had built on, and they built this huge, it's called the Oneida Mansion. You can still go and visit it today. I actually kind of want to go see it. But they built this huge communal mansion on this property. They tried to focus on, in the beginning, mainly agricultural pursuits. Mm-hmm. But they ran an orchard, but this kind of proved difficult in the winter because they didn't have any income coming in the winter.
Yeah, because you can't do the farm on the winter.
Right. But they decided to capitalize on the talents of member Seymour Newhouse, who happened to be a master animal trap craftsman.
Oh, wait. Animal trap craftsmen?
Yeah. 1800s.
Trapping animals?
There's still lots of trappers.
Okay.
Newhouse worked with the other members, some other members who were expert machinists, and the group managed to open factories that produced traps.
Okay.
They then opened factories that made twisted silk thread for sewing machines.
Okay.
Again, from the Collector's Weekly article, quote, while the women of Oneida eschewed vanity, the community benefited from Victorian women's obsession with the latest trends. The traps provided them with the most chic furs, while Oneida's threads were always offered in the season's hottest colors. Okay. It was only a matter of time before... So obviously they're living in this communal living situation. Some would call it communism.
Crazy.
Right? But they eventually had to make like a full transition into the capitalistic market in order to keep up with the rest of the world. So while the members were really working like 4 to 6 hours at a time in their factories, kind of had these really, I mean, it was like really nice working hours, they eventually had to hire wage laborers and outside wage laborers to keep up with demand. At one point, they attempted to get into the chain link business, but the attempt failed.
It's very hard to get into the chain link business.
Yes. But in 1877, they had an inspiration to start making silverware.
Silverware? Mm-hmm. How do they do it?
Initially, they started with tin spoons before expanding to a full set of flatware. Now, shortly after the silverware business began taking off, it became apparent to the rest of the community that Noyes was in decline. Like, at this point, he was old. He had become elderly. He was basically deaf. He didn't, like, speak at any events or any meetings anymore. This was in, like, the 1870s. So some of the young men in the community decided to start attending college out there in the real world and came back with some skepticism to like what was happening.
Yeah.
So there was kind of this rift happening within the community itself. There were some other things happening in the outside world at the same time that kind of put pressure on the group as well. In 1873, Congress passed the Comstock Law that dealt with obscenity. In 1878, they saw the banning of polygamy in Utah, thanks to the Mormons.
The Mormons be crazy.
Mm-hmm. And by June of 1879, the Syracuse Standard announced that authorities were preparing to arrest Noyes for his, like, polygamy, essentially.
He's too old to have polygamy, like, fuck sessions now, you know?
Yeah, and that's one of the things I mentioned in these articles, too. Like, obviously, like, his sexual prowess was in the decline, you know? But he heard this, got wigged out, and under the cover of darkness, like, fled to Canada. It's like peace.
Where polygamy is totally chill.
So he flees to Canada, and Oneida, the Oneida community was kind of on the outs. There was a lot of worry about what would happen to these women and children in the community, many of which who had multiple partners, multiple fathers, going into the outside community as like a woman with multiple children by multiple fathers. You're talking about your kids being bastards and you being a harlot. Like, what happens to these women? So Noyes decided that it was time to end the practice of complex marriage.
Okay.
And sent notice to the community in New York to have a vote on it. And the community overwhelmingly agreed with him. Like, okay, we're going to be done with the complex marriage thing. The free love's
too
over.
Fucking complex. Yeah.
There was some more like internal disagreement about how Oneida should move forward. Eventually in 1880, they decided that the Oneida community should break up and restructure its businesses as a joint stock company, Oneida Community Limited. Okay. The shares were divided up based on who initially invested the most money, into the community, as well as how much labor the individual put into it. So they kind of like, a lot of it was the original members. They kind of decided to split it up with people in the community, but there were some who just... Not many, but like some women who were just kind of left out in the cold, essentially. Mm-hmm. One of the women, Harriet Worden, had a child by Noyes, named Pierre Pont. Yeah, like Pierre and Pont. Pierrepont.
Oh, not like a DuPont.
No.
Like Pierrepont. Yeah. Okay.
And he ended up coming back to essentially revamp the Oneida company into a silver company. So Noyes dies from what sounded like old age to me. I didn't see just any like
being an old fucker.
He dies literally in 1886. And some of the original Oneida members continued to run like the various businesses that were kind of under this Oneida umbrella. There were still a few people who counted on Noyes for spiritual guidance and often participated in the seance scene that was like very big at the time. So they would go to seances and be like, Noyes, tell us what to do.
Ooh, make the table jimmy.
So they did that. The trap making slowed down. By 1900, Pierrepont decided to drop the thread making and the canning from the Oneida business, like the Oneida catalog. The trap making slowed down. They eventually got discontinued in 1925.
Yeah, people stopped wearing furs.
Yeah.
You know, and depression I'm sure and all that.
Trapping methods had improved. I mean, we're talking
They were doing farming.
Right.
So they were raising animal, like mink farms and things like that.
And we're talking like the old style metal, like, you know, pull them apart traps. Yeah. So Oneida decided that at that point it was going full on in flatware, and they were going to dominate the silver flatware market. So they essentially cornered the market on affordable flatware by offering triple plate silver in fresh modern designs that allowed middle class families to have nice cutlery without having nice cutlery at affordable prices.
Yeah, essentially. Not full silver.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was like they talk about how there was like the cheap stuff. And then there was the super nice silver, but there was no in between.
Yeah, because the cheap stuff had like fucking lead in it and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like it was like not good tin. It was like shitty aluminum. Yeah.
So they were like, well, let's hit this middle area so that people didn't have to save and save and save to get like nice silverware. Mm-hmm. The brand itself was called Community Plate.
Oh. Sounds like a grocery store now.
So the Oneida Community Limited, I think now it's just Oneida Limited, but still exists as a successful company.
Check your drawers, people.
Literally. They are one of the world's largest designers and sellers of stainless steel and silver-plated cutlery and tableware, and the largest supplier of dinnerware to the food service industry in North America.
Yeah, so you're eating communist sex cult silverware, okay?
It's true. As I was looking through, you know, a lot of these articles pop up on like collector websites for silverware collectors and stuff. And there was one that had a ton of images of what the silverware looked like. And they showed one that was from King Edward. Was he the one who abdicated? Sure. I forget. I think it might have been King Edward.
Phil or an Ed? I don't know.
Yeah. The one who abdicated the throne. Mm-hmm. I cannot remember.
For love, baby.
They did a design for his coronation that was then like reproduced even after he abdicated. And I was looking at it, I was like, I feel like we had very similar like silverware at my parents' house when I was younger that has like since been replaced. Mm-hmm. But it's very nice stuff.
I'm pretty sure we had some.
Yeah. Yeah, you could probably look and see if it says Oneida. You might have cult silverware.
I love good sex cult cutlery. Yeah.
So after 124 years, Oneida Limited announced that it was ending all U.S. manufacturing operations in 2005.
That's such a long time.
Moved all of it overseas. There was some like combining of their company and some other silverware companies. Now there's only one U.S. made flatware maker in the entire United States. Mm. But Oneida is still like the largest distributor here. So that's kind of the story. I know Tiff sent it over because of the silver connection, which is just like weird.
Yeah. But also not the first time that a fucking cult produced something.
No. But it's still around today, too. There was the one that had all the cafes in, like, California, too.
Yeah.
Like, all those cafes are still
vegetarian
open.
Vegetarian food cafes.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's not uncommon for, like, these organizations to stick around as businesses in some mm-hmm. sort of way.
Which is always the antithesis of what they start out as. They're like, no, we're just doing it for ourselves and our community. And then it's like, oh, capitalism.
Yeah.
Surprise capitalism.
Yeah. When Pierpont Noyes like took over, he pretty much disconnected all of the spiritual stuff. He came in and like thought like a businessman and was like, yeah, we're not dealing with any of the spiritual stuff at all. Mm-hmm. So like I'm pretty confident in saying you can buy Oneida guilt free now.
I feel Jesus in these forks tonight.
Yeah. The electric Jesus in my forks.
Yeah.
I think you can buy guilt free now and like be fine. There are no like remaining Oneida members still alive. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because when he came back and like made,
there's, does it say it on their website? Like from the ruins of a religious sex cult comes cutlery.
It definitely does not. I meant to pull up. Oh, let's see. Oh my
God. Cause like, yeah. How do you navigate?
Food utensils. Nope. Oneida.com. Find your flatware favorites. Yeah, so you can see they're a part of a bunch of their brands: Lennox, Kate Spade, New York, Reed and Barton, and Kate Cambridge.
Spade.
Yeah, dude. Do they have an about me? Their silverware is really pretty, though. Oh, they have one of these pages that just keeps autofilling. Here we go. About us.
You sure do.
Oneida was established in upstate New York as a way to get to utopia. This is from their website. To support the community, our members began to make silverware. Soon they became famous as Oneida's quality was utopian.
That's not even how that word works.
Yeah, they talk about what is silverware,
what is silverware?
Yeah, how it can fight bacteria, blah, 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 blah.
Wait, what? Fight bacteria?
Comes with properties that can help fight bacteria. Before disinfectants, the various utensils like cups, candlesticks, spoons, plates, and table weights were coated in silver so as to keep them sanitary.
Okay.
With the advent of modern soaps and dishwashers, real silver was no longer necessary. Now we use stainless steel, but the name stuck. Any household utensil is iconic silverware, blah, 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 blah. Oneida revolutionized the entire industry when it first came up with stainless steel flatware back in the 1960s. The high-end products that anyone could afford, the whole world would have access to the finest flatware. Now, the whole world wanted Oneida. So, yeah, it doesn't necessarily mention the cult, but that's really interesting.
They say utopia.
As a way to get utopia and call their quality utopian. So, like...
So, they give a little wink and a little nod.
A little tongue-in-cheek.
Because they know that that's people really are going to look it up and be like, the fuck my silverware is all about... religion.
Yeah, they do have 25% off site wide, BT dubs.
If you're looking top notch utopian
flatware,
silverware.
Let's see. I'm curious what the price is. Oh.
No.
They have a champagne satin 20 piece flatware set on sale for $60. But it looks about $120 a set or so. Ooh, this one's $210. Ooh. Damn. This one's $370. Oh, that's 40 pieces. Anyway, so that was Oneida. We don't have to sit. This is not a silverware podcast.
I mean, should it be?
It might be.
Before you email.
Before you decide what silverware you're going to buy from Oneida, because it's utopian.
Which one screams like shared partners?
Actually, they have like a black mat set that I really dig. Mm. Yeah. Anyway, check out this podcast.
And I'm scared we exist in the Matrix.
I'm Jaslyn, and I'm bad at ad-libbing.
And you're listening to High Expectations, the promo. For our international listeners, you can appreciate our cute New Zealand accents. For our local listeners, you might bump into us in the street 3 times in the same hour. Our podcast is about pop culture,
sexuality,
relationships,
interesting hobbies,
banter, and ragging on each other.
You can find us on
Apple Podcasts,
SoundCloud,
Pocket Casts,
Podcast Addict,
or anywhere you might like to find podcasts.
Yay, please subscribe.
Goodbye.
Well, that has been our show. Thanks for coming to our silverware chat.
You know, for our anniversary, we had to really bring it back to the cults, the sex cults.
It's true. It's
always
true. I don't think we have anything coming up, really.
Yeah. You'd be wrong.
Oh, I guess we do. Janelle, tell me about what's coming up, because I have no idea.
We will have another in-person show in November with Haunted Rockford.
Oh, yeah.
Did you forget about that?
There will be more details to come, but it'll be sometime in the middle of Rockford. In the middle of November. So keep an eye out for that. We will have more information as it comes in. It's just being set up right now.
Yes.
But I will remind you every month until November.
Yeah, come to our show.
I'll need a reminder too.
Yeah. But other than that, we don't have anything else.
Good. On that note, our sound and editing is by Tiff Fullman. Our music is by Jason Zakshevsky, The Enigma. This has been the Bad Taste Crime Podcast. We'll see you in 2 weeks. Happy anniversary.
Happy anniversary. Happy anniversary. Happy anniversary. Happy anniversary. Six more years.
Oh, God. That's a lot.
That's a big
You're
commitment.
Asking a lot of me on a Sunday morning. I can barely make a 6 month commitment.
Yeah.
Six more. Get out of here. Over this town. We are all people in some form or another. Which one of these patterns says don't come?